I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. To start the eighth year of the program, I'm delighted to have on now a good friend of the show, the author, journalist, and former editor of Chatelaine, Rona Maynard. Her website is at ronamaynard.com, where you'll find her blog. I read it regularly because there's always something practical, whether it's about books or when it provides an opportunity to think about important times and places in one's life that you probably wouldn't have otherwise. For example, there's a nice piece on her blog on unforgettable teachers, which is something I want to talk about. There's always much to talk about whenever Rona's on. Her previous book is My Mother's Daughter, and she's a popular speaker across the country. Please welcome back to the Planta on the Line program, Rona Maynard. Good morning, Ms. Maynard.
I'm delighted to be with you, Joe.
How was your summer?
Well, I went to Italy for 3 weeks, so
That's right.
Made it pretty special.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess when you were in town, I guess in the spring, in March, you mentioned that you were going to Italy. We've talked in the past about you taking books on a vacation. This is, I guess, the first vacation that you decided to take an e-reader?
Yes, and I researched it for weeks in advance because I didn't want to make the wrong decision. I wanted to buy the right one for me, and I went with Kindle, and I absolutely loved it. I can't tell you how much trouble this device saved me because I'm one of these people who have to be prepared for every kind of reading mood, something light, something gripping, something informative. Sometimes I even like a bit of poetry to dip into. So that's a lot of books. And with an e-reader, I found that I always had it in my tote bag, ready to pull out when I had some spare time, and I didn't have to lug all that stuff around.
And was there a reticence on your part to go to an e-reader to begin with? Or was it just the convenience of it?
Well, I had never felt the need for one. I'm a traditionalist. I like the feel of turning pages. I like to look at book covers. When I'm in a bookstore, I make my choice partly based on the cover illustration and the cover copy, and it's a very tactile thing. I'm often persuaded to pick up a book by what I see displayed on the shelf in front of me. I find that when I have an e-reader with me, what I might do is see a book on the shelf and then order it immediately on my e-reader from the store.
Yeah, and the books are cheaper too, aren't they?
They are cheaper, although sometimes they're not as cheap as you think they are going to be. I try not to spend more than about $10.
And has it changed the relationship with real books? Like, are you buying fewer?
No, actually, and this came as a bit of a surprise. I still enjoy being seduced by real books, and not all books that I might want to read are available for my e-reader. For example, there's a new Canadian book that I read about. It's a memoir by an 80-year-old woman named Lori Lewis. It's called Little Comrades. I read about it, and I thought, oh, that sounds like my kind of book. Well, you can't get a Kindle edition, so I just had to buy the book.
Yeah.
And I found it was a beautifully designed book. I really liked the paper. I liked turning the pages. And I wasn't thinking, oh, if only it could be on my e-reader. Where the e-reader really shines is for travel.
Yeah.
And another wonderful thing about it is that you can get a little light, at least if you have the Kindle, so that you can be in a dark place, you can be in a hotel room where the other person is sleeping, and you can see just fine.
I mean, we've been hearing the end of books for, I guess, the last 25, 30 years or so. Is this a turning point, do you think, in that discussion that books I mean, we're seeing already the change at one of the big chains here in this country, I guess the only chain in this country, where they're sort of focusing on their own device, and their own stores are changing the way that they receive books from publishers.
Yes. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of the big chains is also selling more e-books than regular books now. But, you know, I think this will ultimately be great for authors, because I think it'll cause the public to buy more books.
Yeah. I've noticed that, too, myself. Sometimes I'll have an interview, and they don't send the book in time, so I have to end up buying it. And so I end up buying it online, reading it off my laptop.
Well, reading from a Kindle is going to be much, much nicer than reading off a laptop.
Oh, it is, yeah.
Oh, it's just great. It's very easy on the eyes. You can adjust it infinitely. And, of course, the portability can't be beat. You can, for women, it's purse-sized. It's great for reading on the bus. A lot of books are big and heavy. For example, I would not want to carry Keith Richards' memoir with me.
Mm-hmm.
Even the paperback is big, chunky. That book is great for an e-reader.
Say, have you gotten your own book on your Kindle?
No, I don't. There is a Kindle edition, but I don't happen to have it.
Yeah. The Emmys were last night, and last week there was a Miss Universe pageant, and I was just thinking to myself that these I guess they're largely American cultural institutions. They used to be big, and nowadays we don't really pay attention to those things. Do you have a reason why?
Beauty contests? Well, the ones that seem to be getting all the attention are these eyebrow-raising, shocking competitions involving little girls.
Yeah.
Those I get very upset about. But the beauty pageants that I used to watch as a little girl, I couldn't care less, and I don't know who cares.
And that's the same with award shows. I mean, the ratings spell that out, don't they?
Miss America always was supposed to be about more than just beauty. There was Miss Congeniality, and I think there was a Miss Talent. But really, it was about some kind of very 1930s ideal of femininity that has just disappeared by now.
And that's a good thing, I guess?
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
It does, although I must say it fascinates me that women who probably don't pay any attention to beauty contests for adults are into this baby beauty contest thing for their daughters.
Yeah. I've seen that show. I've seen it once, and it's just sick. It just makes you want to throw up.
Well, little girls want to please their parents.
Yeah.
And if they think this is going to make mom happy, chances are they'll do it. Plus, it extends the perennial appeal of dress-up.
Uh-huh.
This is dress-up on the ultimate scale.
Yeah, I know we're not supposed to think we're better than other people, but I think you watch an episode of Toddlers and Tiaras, and you know you're better than some people, I guess. So, you have on your blog a piece about a teacher of yours, and it struck me because it made me think about sort of the teachers in my life. I guess Mr. Milliken was a teacher of yours, and he passed away recently, right?
Yes, he died in his 80s. He taught Latin at my school. He was the only Latin teacher that the school ever had. He started the program in the 60s, and when he retired, he knew that it would not be replaced, that he would not be replaced,
right,
and that Latin would die. It must have been terribly sad for him. He was a man who loved students and loved his subject. And his goal was not to teach us vocabulary or sentence structure. Of course, you are going to get some of that if you study Latin, but rather to get us excited about a great ancient civilization that continues to influence the world today. And I can tell you that when I was in Rome in May, I kept thinking of Mr. Millikan as I walked around the Eternal City. And I stood at the place where Caesar was assassinated, and I thought, oh, if only he could be here to tell me a story or two.
Yeah, I spent the summer watching The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and then the other day I watched The History Boys, and it made me think about sort of the teachers that I've had in my life. And do you find that I mean, there's always one teacher that stands out, and was that Mr. Millikan for you?
Oh, there were many, actually. Yeah. But at the time, I think I took Mr. Millikan very much for granted. Because I thought Latin was one of the more pleasurable subjects, but I really thought I was too good for my high school. Couldn't wait to get out of there. I thought university days would bring the real teachers, the real influences on my life. But I think that every good teacher is really teaching life. And it doesn't matter what they're teaching. They could be teaching shop. They could be teaching art. They could be teaching biology. They could be teaching Latin. A great teacher is modeling curiosity, ethics, commitment, the importance of staying with a task even when the going gets tough. These are things that young people need to know, and they don't want to learn them from their parents necessarily. When you're tuning out your parents, you might listen to a teacher.
Yeah. I mean, now, you yourself, you're known as a bit of a mentor for people in, I guess, in journalism and the sort. Is that something that you sought yourself to do, or is that something that just sort of came naturally with the sort of jobs that you've had over the years?
It came very naturally to me. An editor has a chance to be a teacher, and I liked that role. I liked sharing what I had learned about making words sing on the page, about creating vivid word pictures that readers could see. Not everybody gets into that aspect of editing, but I sure did. And in the beginning, I was over-enthusiastic, and I went into way too much detail and went off in too many directions. I've learned that when you're teaching somebody, you shouldn't ask yourself right out of the gate, well, what's wrong with this? First ask, what's right with it? And then try to build on the strengths. And then zero in on the several things, not more than two or three, that would really take this person you're mentoring farther. But don't critique every single thing that could be better.
And you found that in being a mentor yourself, that it's been personally rewarding?
Oh, absolutely. I came to realize after I left my job that was the only aspect of it that I missed.
Yeah.
I was ready to let all the corporate stuff go, and there's a limit to how many years I was willing to spend editing a magazine that had to deal with Turkey every December.
Yeah, yeah. You do some of the mentoring, I guess, again, with these memoir workshops that you run, and we've talked about that in the past. I mentioned your book earlier, and I was just wondering, how do you think your life would have been different had you not written that book? I mean, writing a memoir, I assume, it changes one's life because you've spent time looking at it in the process of writing it. Is that the case with My Mother's Daughter?
Well, it changed my life in that it was the first piece of work I'd ever done that I could control totally. It was not being sandwiched in between ads in a magazine. It was by me, for me. It was me using my own talents to tell my own story, and that was absolutely liberating. But my perspective on my story keeps changing and evolving. And just recently, in fact, I came to realize that work was really a lifesaver for me. And you could say that that's in the book, but I could take it so much farther. And in fact, I do in my keynote speaking. My new keynote speech is called The Healing Power of Work. And in it, I explain how it wasn't just therapy that pulled me out of depression. Therapy gave me the tools to create a better life, and part of that picture was pushing my talents in the workplace, finding a place where I could shine there.
And so do you miss work now? I mean, you don't really have a full-time job anymore.
I don't have a job, but I do work.
Yeah.
I run my workshop. I do keynote speaking. I'm exploring a volunteer opportunity. It is not about having a place to go every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's about staying engaged, and it's about having a group of colleagues.
Now, these memoir workshops, you run them, they're primarily women, aren't they, that go to
them?
They
are exclusively for women, and yeah. I'm sometimes asked, well, can I bring my husband, or I have a friend who would like to come who's male. What's with this all women stuff? And quite simply, the atmosphere in the groups would change if the women couldn't feel completely free to share their innermost experiences. We talk a lot about our lives in these groups, and that's how it has to be. That's what makes the group special. We talk about divorce. We talk about breast cancer. We talk about first love. We talk about death of an ex-husband. And it's a very female kind of discussion. I think the energy would change.
And the people that go to these workshops, are they're not writers, are they, or are they?
Well, for the most part, no. I've had people come who never have written before. I've had a woman come who's a leader in her field, and what she submitted was essentially a resume. By the way, she had a wonderful time. I have other people come who have publishing credits. An editor-in-chief of a magazine came. Some of the people have little communications companies. So I do get some more experienced writers, but they haven't had the opportunity to do this kind of writing, to tell their own story with a really seasoned mentor.
And is the goal for them when they show up to get published?
Not for the most part. I always tell people that this workshop will improve your chances of getting published insofar as it'll make you a better writer. But don't get hung up on publication, because there are so many reasons to write. One is to preserve your own memories for yourself.
Yeah.
They fade so quickly. Another is to hand down a testament to your children. Another is self-knowledge, finding the patterns in your own experience. you can share your work with 5 readers, and if there are 5 really good readers in your family or circle of friends, why is that not a reason to write? You don't need 5,000 or 5 million readers.
Yeah. And so that goes back to the earlier question about writing your own book. It is a worthwhile experience, I guess, in terms of finding out about yourself and I guess moving forward. Is that right?
Capturing your story on the page, looking at it and saying, yes, that's exactly what I meant to say,
yeah,
is liberating. And seeing in that story things that you didn't see before, making connections you weren't able to make.
I've asked you this, I guess, the first time that you were on for that book, if you were working on another book, because I remember some of the reviews of My Mother's Daughter were saying that they wanted you to write more. Are you working on another book?
I'm not.
No.
But you never know.
Yeah.
Because I'm certainly always keeping my eyes and ears open. I'm always watching the human scene and endlessly fascinated by it. Lately, I've been rewriting a number of my keynote speeches, and that's been taking quite a lot of time. So I'm being pulled in another direction right now, but that could change.
Yeah. Rona, as always, it's always great to talk to you. I enjoy these chats, and I find that there's more that we can talk about.
I look forward to the next one, and I want to hear how you're liking your e-reader.
I haven't gotten one yet. So
you will, though.
I will.
Okay.
Yeah. RonaMaynard.com is the website. My Mother's Daughter is the book. It's worth picking up. I enjoyed it years ago, and I still think about it from time to time. Rona Maynard on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.